Welcome to the Long River Podcast. My name is Graham Rhodes, and I'm delighted to be here today with Day Dunn, author of the East Asia Stocks Insight Substack. Hey, Day, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Graham. Great to be here. How are you?
I'm doing good, and I'm excited to speak with you today. We're going to talk about two of the companies you profiled on your Substack recently, Anta and Li-Ning, as a window into the Chinese sportswear industry. But before we go any further, I have to give the usual disclaimer. None of what we go on to talk about is investment advice, so please don't treat it as such. Everyone should always do their own homework. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Day, why don't you begin by giving us a quick recap of your CV?
Yeah, okay. Let me just give you a quick personal background. The thing is, people are often confused. I usually need a minute to explain because I'm Chinese by background, so my parents are Chinese, but I was born in Japan. And lived in Japan until I was nine. And my family and I, we immigrated to Canada, where I went to school, did my undergrad at the University of Toronto, and worked in Toronto for 5 or 6 years after I graduated. And then I flew to Hong Kong. I moved to Hong Kong, worked in Hong Kong for 3 years. And then now I'm in South Korea. So I've been all over the place. But in terms of my career, I spent almost 10 years on the buy side, covering Asia. East Asia, actually, at two shops. And they were both long only. And I had the chance to work on a number of different mandates during this time, which included a Japan-only mandate, a Pan-Asia mandate. And I also had the chance to look at Asia as part of a global fund, along with some colleagues that looked at other parts of the globe. And so I was in the industry till 2021. And then now I'm an independent analyst, operating my own research platform called East Asia Stock Insights.
And until, I think, late last year, earlier this year, you were writing in partnership on another Substack, but you launched the East Asia Stocks Insights Substack because, in your words, you think this is the most exciting region in the world for investors today. Can you tell us why?
Just speaking from the perspective of allocating my own capital as an investor myself, I'm really excited about the region today. And I think it's likely to draw more investor attention going forward. Just quickly on that. So like by East Asia, Japan, just three countries, basically Japan, China, and Korea. And with Japan, it's the story is the most well-known among the three here. The investor interest is really high right now. And I think mostly for great reasons here, as people know, like governance improvements. Warren Buffett has recently made some investments, right? And the macro situation is also very interesting with kind of into deflation in sight, right? With all the wage increases and whatnot. I think the story here is not over and there's a lot of interesting things going on. Today, I guess we're going to talk more about China, and that's a lot more controversial, I suppose, with the risks here are, you know, basically well known, right? Political, regulatory, all that stuff. But at the same time, the market's valuation is at a historic low. And I just can't help but to think that there are opportunities here in some names and just also starting to see actually more value investors start picking away at things too. And then there's last one's Korea. I guess that's the least well known to global investors, I think. And for myself too, it's a region where I'm doing the most to actually ramp up myself, but it's super cheap. And then it's also like a Western aligned democracy with rule of law, just like Japan. I think maybe the market will still need some reforms, but I'm just watching it closely to see if it could become the next Japan, so to speak.
If you're going to spend time anywhere in the world, I think you've chosen a good spot. So Dave, who is your target audience, do you think? And what kind of content do you plan to publish?
Yeah. So most of my subscribers are professional investors, portfolio managers and analysts on the buy side, I would say 80%. In terms of the content I publish, most of it will be stock write-ups. Given my own career experience working at long-only shops, I guess my focus here is really just on understanding the businesses, the industries, and the drivers from a long-term perspective. And I think so what I write, I think will cater to the long-only crowd. And in terms of my region of focus, right now I'm spending about 70% of my time on Japan. And I think that's what you can expect in terms of the contents coming out. But depending on investor interest, market valuations, all these things, this could change in the future.
And do you think you'll address, because you mentioned these, right, like the geopolitical or macroeconomic risks, will that feature in your writing? Or do you think you'll take it almost for granted that the people who subscribe are comfortable with those?
The short answer is no. And I would say that I feel like when it comes to these topics, right, like geopolitics, people have made up their minds already on this. Or at the very least, I think it takes too much effort to change one's view. And I'd rather spend that time somewhere else. I think maybe like Twitter or X is a better place to express these things. At least no one's paying me for these things.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And how do you pick the companies you profile?
So broadly, there are two kinds of companies that I choose to profile. One is companies that are, I believe, actionable and can make money. Although obviously, nothing's investment advice, right? I'm never going to make any guarantees or anything like that in my write-ups. But having said that, I think it will be fairly obvious to my readers when they see an idea that I'm bullish on or that I see it being actionable for myself. And so that's one category. And the other one is there are some companies out there where even though they're not, you know, valuation is expensive and then maybe the risk reward's not great, but they're very important companies that I feel like more investors ought to know, just given their size or their position in the value chain or just how exceptionally good the businesses are, for instance. Yep. So an example of that, just to give you like ones that I've written about in the past, would be like, say, a Recruit Holdings in Japan, right? Or Keyence in Japan. So,
yep.
so those are like the two types, and I alternate between these two categories.
The first time you came onto my radar really was with your excellent write-up of the Japanese trading companies. And
I thought
you did a wonderful job, like kind of busting some myths, actually.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I learned from you, for example, is that they're actually among the top choice for graduates to work at.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And one of the reasons is because you get so much entrepreneurial autonomy when you go there. Again, I had no idea about that. So I thought you did a really good job with that one.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
So we're here today to talk about Anta and Leaning, just to really illustrate, like, I guess, the kind of companies you choose and how you think about them. So you wrote about Anta and Leaning earlier this month, and you also gave like a primer on the Chinese sportswear industry at large. Why did you choose to begin with these companies in this industry?
First of all, just that fact alone, I guess, implicitly hints at how much I like these companies as investment ideas myself. I own these myself, although this is not investment advice. Nothing I say is recommendation. There's also a trend that I'm trying to explore with these companies, which is the fact that I think the landscape in China has changed a lot over the years. And what I mean by that is local brands, local companies like these are thriving. And Chinese companies have really moved up the value chain. So if you are, let's say, like a quality, long-term biased investor, I feel like a lot of these Chinese companies have become champions and they should be more interesting to these groups of investors. On the other hand, I don't think that we're going to talk about Nike, we're going to talk about Adidas. I don't think it means multinationals are screwed in China. But having said that, I do think many investors in the past, they've perhaps relied too heavily on investing in these multinationals to obtain their China exposure. And I think you got to start gradually questioning whether that's the best strategy, especially when these Chinese companies are becoming champions in the industry. So I just wanted to explore this and use sportswear companies as one example.
So your first piece on the industry gave us the macro view. Why don't you set the scene with that?
China's obviously, over the years, their spending on sportswear, all things sports, have grown. And the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, that was a big event. That was a turning point in many ways that I think we'll discuss more later. One of the big tailwinds here has been government policy. And that's something I went into depth in my report. So people might not know the fact that everyone knows what the five-year plans are, right? But people might be surprised when I say sports is actually squarely mentioned in those plans from the highest levels of the Chinese government. And they've done a lot of things like increase the number of sports facilities, increase the sporting population. But what's also really interesting here is that they're even targeting things at a very micro level, right? Things like private sector spending on sports. So they're targeting 2.5% of disposable income spent on sports consumption, which is interesting because this is obviously going to flow through to the companies like sportswear makers. So that's one interesting thing, just given, you know, like how detailed and precise some of these targets have been, how they've been able to quantify a lot of this.
If I can just jump in there, why is the government targeting sports?
I've asked that question a lot too. Like, why do they care so much? Is it just about healthy living, like making its citizens healthier? And I think that's definitely a big part of it. But then there's also this more important concept here, which is that of cultural soft power and national unity, national cohesion. Because everyone knows nationalism is a huge thing in China in recent years. And there's really no better way to unite the people than sports. This is why China cares so much, I think, about the Olympics and the number of gold medals, things like that.
Yeah.
And if you also think about it, right, like athletes are literally like the most admired people on the planet, like regardless of skin color, regardless of religious beliefs, like they're just so admired. And it's one way for China, I think, to capture more soft power around the globe by producing star athletes, things like that. So in other words, I think it's this whole thing is far more strategic than people realize.
Yeah. And what about the quality of the companies themselves or the industry itself from a business point of view?
I like it. I really like it. Of course, there are several reasons, right? And Graham, maybe if you want to, you can add to this because I'm by no means an expert on the industry. But here's one thing about just sportswear. You can really never underestimate the importance of the brand because you're ultimately dealing in a category of self-expression. Think about the sponsorship on athletes. Like people have emotional attachments to their favorite athletes, right? Kevin Durant, LeBron, whatever. And people will pay up for this. So I think it's a category where, you know, if you have the right brands, money will be made. The other thing I think is that I think people underestimate like how hard it is to really build a really sustainably strong brand in this industry. Because once in a while, you have a new guy that comes in. It's like the hottest thing, whether they have a great technology or design, but they get into trouble, right? Margin evaporates. Like operating a business in this sustainably is very hard. That's why you got so few like Nikes out there. Anyways, it's just an industry where the more I learn about it, the more I feel like it's a very complex machine that they're running here, even though a lot of this is intangible. And I'm just amazed at what it takes for these guys to keep winning at this game.
I would just add, and I'll maybe put this in the show notes or something. You can look at a chart of market caps in this industry and it follows a power law, which is quite remarkable. And that suggests that there's some kind of increasing returns to scale here. And I think that it expresses itself in two ways. You talked about like the technical side of the product. I think if you have the money and the will, you can always keep pushing that forward, which will always give a company like Nike or perhaps the ones we're talking about today some kind of distinctiveness over their competitors. But it will also give consumers another reason to go back and keep buying the product again and again and again. It keeps getting better and better. And then on the other side, I think the nature of those endorsements you talked about is that they're somewhat oligopolistic as well, because they're so expensive that only a few companies can really afford them.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely seems to be an industry where there's real advantages to having scale. I would just add another advantage is just like the breadth of product lineup. That's a huge advantage. Like Nike, for instance, is strong in both apparel and footwear. And actually, same goes with company like Anta, as we'll discuss later. But I think it's very hard to get there. But once you have it, it's actually very hard for competitors to emulate.
Why don't you give us a history of the Chinese sportswear industry from the bottom up now? So how did these companies begin? What are their origins? And I think it's really cool how you chose Anta and Li Ning because they have such different backgrounds, actually. Why don't you kick off with that?
So Chinese brands didn't actually exist until the early 90s. All these Western brands, they make their products in China, right? So Chinese brands actually started as contract manufacturers to the big Western brands after China opened up. Mm-hmm. But eventually, some smart entrepreneurs in China, they realized that the money wasn't actually in the contract manufacturing, but it was in owning these brands. And Li Ning was actually one of the first brands to develop in 1990. Followed by a lot of brands in the mid to late 90s, including Anta. Although the genesis of these two companies is very different because Li Ning was started by basically Olympics legend himself, Mr. Li Ning. Meanwhile, Ding Shizhong, who is Anta's founder, came from the contract manufacturing side. Anyways, we can get into more of this later, but just on the history itself. So from the 90s, right, to the 2000s, like growth was really strong, and especially leading up to the Beijing Olympics. Mm. But this was really like a classic China boom and bust story, because after the Olympics, like everyone got, all the brands got carried away. They started opening stores like crazy. They overproduced. And then the industry went through a huge downturn from around 2011 to 2014 period. And this was a really painful period for a lot of the Chinese brands. But interestingly, it was also where a lot of the Chinese brands, through this down cycle, they took the time to try to like look at, okay, reflect and see what's wrong with their business to try to improve it. Many firms invested a lot in IT during this period so that they can gather and analyze more data in their operations. That's one example. They also really professionalized their operations during this time. And I do think the ones that survived and came out of this became stronger. But it was also a period where foreign brands started becoming really big in China. So this was around 2010, starting 2010. I would say, you know, the period from 2010 to 2019 was, you can probably call that like the golden years for the foreign brands. Like just look at Nike and Adidas, right? Their market share went from 10% back then to 20% each in just like 8 or 9 years. And yeah.
If we think about like the distinction between the foreign brands and the domestic brands, can you help us understand which segments of the market they're targeting?
I would say foreign brands are obviously more premium, right? But even, I guess, even within the Chinese brands, there is some delineation there. They're not all the same. So among the Chinese brands, Li Ning is considered the most premium, and they're primarily in tiers 1 to 2 cities. Whereas Anta is more of a true mass market. So they have, you know, wider price points and also wider geographic coverage.
You talked about like the golden years for the foreign brands being from 2010 to 2019. What's happened in the last 5 years?
Yeah. So the last 5 years, I would say the industry has entered a new phase. I guess you can call it the post-COVID phase. So foreign brands have been dropping share. Adidas basically went through a heart attack. And even Nike has lost a few percentage points. Meanwhile, the Chinese brands have just been rising. And so the key insight here I want to mention is that news headlines, people, I think a lot of people attribute this to politics, right? And what's been going on. And things like the Xinjiang cotton incident, there were accusations of forced labor and things like that in Xinjiang. And many foreign brands came out and said, we're going to stop procuring cotton from Xinjiang. And Xinjiang's a huge cotton producing province, right? I don't have the numbers in my head, but just you can Google it easily. It accounts for a very meaningful portion of global cotton production. So after that, right, like you had Adidas, their sales went down like 30 to 40% in just one quarter. And all the brands, foreign brands really struggled after. I guess the point I'm trying to make here, though, is that geopolitical events like this, it's certainly a part of it. It's certainly a very important event that influenced the competitive dynamics between the Chinese and the foreign brands. But when people attribute all of this just to the politics itself, I think they're missing the bigger picture, which is that Chinese makers have, over the years, been really improving across all aspects of the business, like product design, marketing, improving the retail experience for customers, their stores. So the way I look at things here is that there's already been shift going on that wasn't expressed in the numbers yet, but events like the Xinjiang incident served as basically a catalyst for what was to come. But the trend has long been in the making, basically.
And just in the same way that rising consumer nationalism was a trend that started many years before the Xinjiang cotton incident. And you can see that with the rise of Li Ning's house brand, Zhongguo Li Ning.
Yeah.
How popular that was.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess actually there's two trends here that I should maybe it would be helpful to clarify, because some people, they use this term patriotic buying, right? It could actually mean either of two things. The first one is a trend where the Chinese people, you know, they're willing to support the Chinese brands more, right? Of course, it's also because Chinese brands have gotten much better. It's not like they're willing to buy garbage just to show support, but it's this support for their homegrown brands. But the other kind of patriotic buying is this trend called Guochao trend. Mm-hmm. So this one's actually like a fashion trend. Literally, you might have seen this, but like hoodies that are yellow and red in color, which is like inspired by the colors of the Chinese flag, mm-hmm. or just having like huge Chinese letter, these big bold Chinese letter printed on the t-shirt. These are like fashion trends. And the former I talked about is actually like a real kind of structural long-term trend, whereas the latter is like cyclical. It's a fashion trend.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
But you'd have to think that for someone who's coming of age today, their impression of a domestic brand is going to be so different from someone who came of age in the early 2000s, like in terms of the quality, the perception, the endorsements that they see. They probably consider these brands as on par with a Nike or an Adidas in some ways.
Yeah. So exactly like you said, I think to understand consumption in the Chinese market, you got to look at like the Gen Z customers. So these mm-hmm. are the people in their, you know, 20s and late teens, right? And to these people, actually, foreign brands actually don't mean as much as it did to their parents' generation. Like this whole stigma with Chinese products, Chinese brands, I think is shrinking with the newer generation. Yeah. And partly, I think it has to do with the fact that like just the environment they grew up in, because in recent years, you got more patriotic education, you got all the media and social narratives focusing on like the great rejuvenation of China and the like the Chinese achievements in the world, all these things, I think have played a role in this change in perception by the younger people.
Or even just in simpler ways, like seeing the Anta logo at the Beijing Winter Olympics,
yeah.
or seeing athletes like Gu Ailin wearing Anta clothes. It's a huge endorsement.
Huge. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah.
Let's shift gears again and let's move to compare and contrast Anta and Li-Ning again, because as you hinted at earlier, they have very different origin stories and the way their businesses have developed is also quite different. So would you mind just telling us in a bit more detail what their origin stories are and where you think they're distinct?
Yeah, sure. Totally very different backgrounds, right? Li-Ning and Ding Shizhong. The founder of Anta. For those that are who are not maybe familiar with Mr. Li-Ning himself, he's an Olympic gymnast. His stardom was really the 1984 Olympics, where he won 6 medals. So I think out of the 6, like 3 were gold or something. So anyways, legend, absolutely like legendary track record. And when you say Li-Ning in China, it's almost like saying Michael Jordan in the US, that kind of weight that the name carries. On the other hand, Ding, the guy was just, he's just like a factory owner or from Fujian province. And Fujian province is where a lot of the contract manufacturing businesses are in China. And even though Anta is the largest sportswear maker today, actually in early history, Ding would talk about how they were like a latecomer and really just struggled, operated in the shadows of Li-Ning for a very long time. So it's a battle between an athletic legend versus what I perceive to be a very astute business builder type in Ding Shizhong.
One of the most interesting differences between them is the multi-brand versus the single brand strategies. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's a very big distinction because Anta operates multiple different brands and nearly all of Anta's brands have been like highly successful. They all contribute pretty meaningfully to Anta's financials. Whereas Li-Ning, on the other hand, it's largely just Li-Ning. And even though Li-Ning's got other brands, they're not really financially meaningful enough. And I don't think that's where the focus is for the company.
So just remind us, what are Anta's brands? What's in its portfolio?
Okay, there's an Anta brand, right? There's an Anta company and the Anta brand. But the Anta brand is the one that's focused on core performance sports. So like basketball, training, running, all these things. There's Fila, which has its roots in Italy. Italia is an Italian brand. Fila is considered as leisure, right? Fashion, but it occupies the high end of the fashion. And Fila is also very meaningful financially. By the way, in terms of revenue, I think Anta is about 50%, Fila is about 40%, and then all else is around 10%. And within that all else, there's one brand that's becoming really big, which is Descente, a Japanese brand.
And that's run in partnership with the listed company in Japan, which is controlled by Itochu, right?
That's right. That's right. So Anta has 56% stake in Descente China, and the Descente company, which is listed in Tokyo, has about 40%. Itochu has like mid-single-digit percent.
Okay. And I think the The case study with Fila is really interesting because that was not a successful brand when Enta acquired it. Could you just tell us a bit about that story?
Yeah. Super impressive. So Enta actually acquired Fila right after the global financial crisis, and they were able to buy it at a pretty big discount. So they only paid 300 million RMB for the China operations at that time. And it's interesting because guess how much profit Enta generates today? They generate what they paid originally for that in just 17 days. That's how much the business has grown. That's how much Enta has been able to grow this business. And I think the really impressive, part of this is just the fact that they've really been able to develop this high-end premium brand in China as a company that originally started from like nothing, right? Like they occupy this, it's like a story of a low-end player being able to just go in and develop this ultra high premium brand, which is today, I think maybe people don't appreciate the fact that like Fila in China is actually more expensive than a Nike or Adidas. And then there are also the Fila brands actually in other regions too. Like it's big in Korea, Taiwan, but China is actually the most expensive region for Fila. Like the selling price, like Fila sells for the highest price in China.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like streetwear, not quite leisure, not quite fashion, but a blend of the two. And it occupies quite a premium segment in the market, popular with middle-aged people and older. Would you say? How would you describe it?
I think so. I think that's accurate because Fila in the past used to be a lot more of a sports brand, but then over time it went into that as leisure direction. And then yeah. I think Enta was the one that kind of really took that sports heritage and then made it into just like a premium brand. I would call it premium mass brand in China.
And I guess this was the genesis of Enta's portfolio approach because Fila operated very much independently from Enta. They shared a lot of the back-end stuff, but the two brands coexisted independently.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned that 10% of other brands. Could you tell us a bit about those? Because I think it's quite interesting what Enta is trying to do there as well.
So Enta has a segment called Others, and most of that comes from Descente. And what's crazy about Descente is that, so they launched Descente China in 2016, and then it only took them 3 years to reach, I think, 1 billion RMB in sales and reach profitability, which is half the time it actually took Fila to achieve. And fast forward to today, Descente's doing 5 billion RMB in revenue this year. And the profitability of that has also gone through the roof. Again, this is a very premium brand, high price point. In that segment, all other segments, Enta's now making 30% operating margin. Most of that is Descente.
So for those who don't know, what is Descente? What kind of person does it target?
So they call it functional sportswear. And what it is really is like, they try to, I think, differentiate themselves by like the fabric, the functional design. So originally it was big in ski wear, these like functional kind of ski jackets, but then they're also in these niche sports, like endurance sports, like triathlon, cycling, rowing, these sorts of things. Where if you look at the athletes in these sports, what they're wearing, I don't know what the right term is, like spandexy. They have these like unique kind of like material. Descente happens to be just really good at those kinds of niche design and material.
So what do you think the advantages are and the disadvantages of a portfolio strategy like Enta's and the more focused, almost single brand strategy like Li-Ning's?
So one advantage I guess I see with the multi-brand strategy is that the distinction or like the delineation is very clear between the brands. So you got for Enta. So you got like Enta is the core sports. Fila is more as leisure fashion. And then you can keep them separate. And one of the reasons why this is, it sounds very straightforward, but why this is so important, right? Is because sportswear makers, they often get into trouble when they start from a core sportswear brand and then they try to go too much. They try to push too much into that fashion direction, right? And then things become diluted. You get like brand confusion. And I actually think that's exactly what we're seeing with Li-Ning right now. Actually, that's sort of their struggle. But anyways, Enta's just been able to do that very well, where each brand has their own very distinct proposition.
But I guess I could point to Nike on the other hand, which seems to operate across so many different sports and categories as a single brand. And in fact, like Nike spent, I think, the better part of the 90s and 2000s unwinding a multi-brand portfolio. Any thoughts on that?
So actually, here's the thing. Maybe I should have mentioned this even before what I said earlier, but I think some context is helpful here, because actually this whole talk about this whole like multi-brand strategy and like single brand strategy, to me, it actually doesn't really make sense in a way, because every Chinese sportswear maker actually pursued a multi-strategy at one point. So you got Antao, obviously, right? But actually Li-Ning itself actually acquired a lot of brands in the past. The only thing is that they just didn't work out so well. Like they actually acquired an Italian brand called Lotto in 2008. And at one point it was bigger than Fila in China. But Li-Ning just struggled. Even if you look at the smaller players in China, right? Like X-Step, who's the third Chinese brand after Antao and Li, they bought K-Swiss. Everyone knows K-Swiss. That's a pretty famous brand. And then also like Merrell, which is an outdoor kind of trekking shoes.
Yeah.
So China is actually unique in that sense. And the reason how, like why it developed this way is because all these global brands, they saw China as a very unique market. So they just saw, given how unique it is, they would just form joint ventures with local companies to operate their China business. And so you happen to see this multi-brand strategy more in China. And funny enough, right? Li-Ning management these days, they love talking about this like single brand strategy, right? They like to emphasize that as if that's a strategy. But in reality, what it was is they were basically left with a single brand strategy after the multi-brand thing failed.
And I think it also reflects how these companies wanted to escape the shadow of their origins, perceived as lower quality, lower price products. And having a foreign brand with all the halo that connotes was one way to do it.
Exactly. I think so. Yeah, exactly.
But I love how you brought up the history of this, because it, again, emphasizes that Anta is doing something right. Like it's made Fila into a huge success where others have not really got much to show for it.
So far, it's been proven, given Anta's success, right? This multi-brand strategy seems to be the winning strategy in China, at the very least.
Let's talk a bit about the cultures of the two different companies. Why don't you introduce what you understand the culture of Anta and Li-Ning to be?
So I would go back to the origin story I talked about, right? Like with Mr. Li-Ning and Mr. Ding Shizhong, the founders of these companies. So let's look at Anta, right? Like they were a latecomer, right? And then obviously they didn't have this Li-Ning name on their products, which was huge. And funny thing, you like, just go Google Ding Shizhong, look at him. He doesn't look like someone who you'd expect to be the head of a sportswear company, right? He's very smart, nerdy, but you're kind of, you know, honestly, my first impression was like, okay, is this the guy who runs China's largest sportswear company? So in my view, whereas Li-Ning success from day one, given just who Li-Ning was, like Anta had to actually like really earn it in the marketplace.
Yep.
And I think everything owes to this guy, Ding Shizhong, and how they did this through culture of hard work, creating this very performance-driven organization. Mm-hmm. So one thing I like to say is like, Li-Ning is the champion athlete, right? But Ding is actually, I think, like a champion business builder.
I like that. And you just hear things or kind of read the tea leaves and the way these companies operate, but it seems like Mr. Li is very hands-on. And the organization reflects the way he operates like that.
So on that point about hands-on, maybe I would actually challenge that a little bit.
Okay.
Because actually, here's the thing. Throughout history, I think Mr. Li-Ning's been at times hands-off and at times hands-on. In the early 90s, right, Li-Ning already had an outsider CEO. And Mr. Li-Ning himself said in an interview that in those early days, he barely even came to the office. And it was like that. Until you had the industry bust from 2011 to 2014. And then the CEO at that time quit at Li-Ning. And then Mr. Li-Ning himself had to come back and manage the business. So I think this was when he was more hands-on.
I see.
And then, you know, you got right now, right? So Mr. Li-Ning, he hired a co-CEO who is a former executive at Uniqlo. It's been like this, I think, since 2018. And then once again, I think Mr. Li-Ning is a bit more hands-off. I heard he's like living in Hong Kong, and he definitely seems to be like spending more time with his family investment vehicle, which is called Viva Goods nowadays.
Okay. I know you wanted to talk about corporate governance as another dimension along which to compare these companies. So why don't you tell us a bit about the corporate governance and your observations there?
I guess maybe even just before we talk about governance, right? One thing I would add to what I said earlier, just on the culture and the leaders, the management here, because one of the criticisms that Leaning gets is for the management. Look, just management's just not good. And I view kind of the reason behind that just being how Mr. Leaning himself has been like a part-time owner. And he's been a reluctant owner too, in the sense that he's got many things on his mind, I think. Like, just look at the M&As he's been doing at Viva, right? Which, by the way, this is like not good governance, right? Talking about governance, like being head of two listed companies at the same time. You also got like related party transactions between the two. Anyways, compare this with Anta, where you got continuous leadership of Mr. Ding, who, from everything I heard about, this guy is just obsessed about business. Like, he's going to sleep and waking up thinking about Anta. So just very different management here. And okay, so I guess just you were asking about the governance part, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, quite honestly, I think there are issues at both Anta and Leaning. They're both not the cleanest. Let's just start with Anta, right? Like, the one here that really sticks out to me is in 2019, they bought Amer, or I don't know how to pronounce that, a few months after.
Just to introduce it, this is the company which recently listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Previously, it was listed in Finland, and it held a portfolio of niche sporting brands like Salomon and others.
That's right. Arc'teryx, Salomon, Wilson. And just a few months after they bought this, they sold 5% of the shares to Anta's insiders, including Mr. Ding, at a 40% discount. And I've poured through their, they had a disclosure on this, but it was really like cryptic, just really poorly disclosed. And they don't talk about the rationale behind this. They don't explain anything. So that really left a bad impression on me. And Leading, on the other hand, I guess we talked about it, right? Like, some related party transactions between the two, that's a little bit difficult to understand. So Mr. Leaning's other company, Viva, which is essentially his family holding company, owns these smaller brands that own factories in China. And for some reason, those factories are also producing shoes for Leaning. And think like this. Luckily, it's not material. But, and by the way, I guess I probably won't have time to go through all these little things in detail here. But if you're interested, I talked about this in my report. But just from a personal point of view as an investor, it's annoying. I can understand why some investors would be turned off here.
So I think another one we should highlight is the distributorship at Anta, because that has been the focus of a number of short reports over the years, questioning its margins and its cash flow. So can you give us the history of Anta's distribution model and how that's changed over time and why that might be controversial?
So actually, Anta's been the subject of numerous short seller attacks. And I think the one that got the most attention there was from Muddy Waters. I think the short report was in 2019. And one of the things that the Muddy Waters accuses Anta of is the fact that the company has these, what it calls like secretly controlled distributors, that presumably Anta could offload its inventory to these secretly controlled distributors at any price it wants to inflate its profit. And that's one of the, that's like their key accusation. On this point, I think the accusation is actually true. Ding is from Fujian province in China. And the funny thing is, the Fujian province is known for this kind of family like business culture, this like clan business culture, where it's quite likely that Ding's distributors were his close associates, family members, distant relatives and such. But the way I see this is not some kind of structure that's fraudulent and designed to siphon money off of Anta's shareholders or anything like that. Because actually, so in early years, there was a lot of logic to using this kind of structure because the industry was extremely cyclical. It was cutthroat. And Anta was a small player. And when you think about the inventory cycle in 2011 to 2014, I actually think this kind of structure was one important reason why Anta actually survived, not only survived, but came out of it stronger. Because you got these distributors who can help mutualize the inventory burden back in the days when Ant didn't have the balance sheet. And even just having distributors that were cooperative during when shit hit the fan and everything was like when the industry was at the bottom, that in itself was like a huge advantage. And yeah, so it had a rationale back in the days. But what happened was actually that as Antal became bigger, they've outgrown this model. And this is why, like from ever since like 2018, 2019, Antal's been shifting to a direct-to-sale, direct-to-consumer model. So like when the short report, when the Muddy Waters report came out, Antal's, I think wholesale channel sales through the whole wholesale channel was about 60% of Antal's sales. So it was quite meaningful back then. But then now it's 10%. And Antal basically consolidates like nearly all of its inventory on the balance sheet. So I think that with this in mind, I think the short seller's argument today is probably less relevant.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important for people to understand the context of what the Chinese market was like in the 1990s and early 2000s as Anta and other companies were growing. It was very fragmented. There really wasn't much of a concept of modern retail, and there certainly wasn't any e-commerce. So to go from a factory where you were making shoes in Fujian to sell nationally was no easy thing to do. And I guess like trusting family members who could be trustworthy and also have the capital was a very natural move to make. But I like the way that you said or described it as Anta outgrew this model. So I think it has, but not every company would have changed with the times, so to speak. And you can just sense the professionalism that the newer Anta exudes as a result of this. That's just my two cents.
I agree.
I wanted to ask as well about, just to round out governance before we talk about another topic. I think capital allocation is really interesting as well when you think about how these companies see their future. Li Ning recently made an investment into Hong Kong real estate, whereas 5 years ago, made a very big investment into a portfolio of global brands.
Yeah.
Could you share your thoughts on that divergence as well?
Yeah. And I think it goes without a saying, by now you can tell that I'm going to say this, but Anta has a much stronger track record with capital allocation. Just on Anta, like what they've done is very impressive in terms of growing the acquired brands in China. We can talk about the financial returns first, right? They bought Amer for $5.6 billion in 2019. And then earlier this year, Amer listed on New York Stock Exchange and is now trading at somewhere $8 to $8.5 billion. So the financial returns have been decent. But what's just more amazing is, as I mentioned, what they've done with brands like Arc'teryx. When they acquired Amer, Amer was only doing like mid-single digit percent of their total sales in China. And then right now, it's like 20-25%.
Mm-hmm.
And then right now, I'm watching in terms of what they're doing with Salomon, Wilson, and how they're trying to bring those into China as well. On the other hand, you have Li Ning, which just like... So here's the thing, right? With Li Ning, like they've had a terrible past track record buying all these businesses. We talked about the multi-brand strategy stuff earlier. And the thing is, no one trusts Li Ning anymore to buy brands given their track record. And I think this is why, like you look at Mr. Li Ning himself is doing all these little tiny brand M&As through his family holding company rather than Li Ning. I feel like, yeah, that's the reason. Maybe that's a good thing that they're not doing that with the public, you know, with Li Ning. But the funny thing is they still managed to find ways to piss off shareholders. Like just splurging $2 billion Hong Kong dollars on a commercial building. Funny enough, the next day they announced they're going to use the same amount, $2 billion, to repurchase their own shares. And I think this news was a lot more well received. And so it was like one step backward and then one step forward.
I think this question of capital allocation is really important because these businesses generate so much cash.
Exactly. And if you look at Anta and Li Ning, they both have fairly large cash balances today. The difference is, though, enormous because Anta has proven that they know what they're doing. And I think, so here's the thing, I've heard people criticize Anta for the cash balance, but in my view, at least, having some dry powder is not necessarily a bad thing, maybe. At least for a company that has proven they know what they're doing and maybe there are some good deals out there that they can take advantage of. Whereas Li Ning is just a totally different story. Like I'm a shareholder and I prefer if they just return everything. But the good thing is that shareholder returns has been increasing there. So at least that's the positive.
Got it. So let's change focus again and talk about more where we are today in the short term. And it seems like we're going through or close to the end of an inventory cycle. And I was just wondering, Day, if you can help us understand, why are inventory cycles such an important and constant feature of the Chinese sportswear industry?
So I think certainly it was the case post the 2008 Olympics period, right? That was when just there were like every player in the industry was fighting for higher market share, right? If you don't produce, someone else will. So it's that led to everyone overproducing and then it was really ugly. But then I think after that, there was consolidation in the market and then management also learned and became better. So I just like that was the peak in terms of the magnitude of the cycle. And I just don't think we'll see like a repeat of that again. And recently we did see some cycle too. I think Fila had struggled a little bit, although it wasn't huge. But I think the cycle we're seeing now is probably more limited to a firm specific issue at Li-Ning rather than the entire industry.
Yeah.
And I guess one more thing I would mention on this is that the retail structure today is also pretty different because back then it was a lot of it was like through wholesalers. And then today the direct to consumer sales is a lot more.
Tell us about what happened at Li-Ning.
They basically overplayed this Guochao fashion trend because if you recall, so this whole thing became really hot around 2018 when China and US, right? There was that trade war. Mm-hmm. And Li-Ning really tried to capitalize on this trend by just going out and making its whole new line of sportswear that's all about like the stuff I said earlier, like China style design. They even brought this to like the New York fashion show and like, the Paris fashion show and it got this, it was on social media and it, for a while it did really well. But again, going back to the point about how this was just nothing more than a fashion, you know, like trend, the fever eventually cooled down. Li-Ning's left with, again, with overproduction and inventories currently.
Yeah. And one thing that you helped me to understand is because Anta has moved now towards more direct-to-consumer sales, when you look at its balance sheet, you have a much clearer idea of inventory in the channel because it is the channel. But with Li-Ning, even though it appears to have lower inventory days, it really doesn't offer you any insight because you don't know what their wholesalers look like.
Yes, that's exactly right. So if you look at the inventory days at Li-Ning, it looks like it's coming down, but then you don't know anything about the days of inventory in the wholesale channel.
And just my impression was like after the Xinjiang cotton incident, domestic brands really caught a lift and people leaned into this, especially the wholesalers expecting another really good 2022. And then because of COVID, actually demand was very weak and they got caught flat-footed with too much inventory. But you were saying you were in Beijing at the end of last year, I think, or earlier this year.
Yeah.
How did this excess inventory manifest itself?
Yeah, I was in Beijing in February and I had the chance to do some store visits in Beijing. One thing I was looking for is just like the discounting situation at all these brands. And yeah, there's some interesting insights here that I want to share. First, I was just really impressed by Anta because they were the only player that had little to no discounting, like close to zero. And I know the fact that Fila was struggling a bit in 2022. But in fact, just 2 days ago, Anta came out with the results and we saw like a strong rebound in Fila margins in 2023. And that kind of goes hand in hand with what I saw there, which is they've gotten rid of the discounts. When you look at the other players, Nike and Adidas, the foreign players first, they were around 10 to 15% discount on average, although I think Adidas had some items at 30%. So they looked like they were still struggling a little bit. Li-Ning was the one that had the largest discounts. And it was primarily on their streetwear items. I saw still discounts from 30 to 50% on those. On the other hand, their core sports is doing really well. Like little to no discounts there. And so I think clearly they went rogue with their whole streetwear expansion. And I think the other thing is they try to premiumize a little too early. Yeah. The streetwear, they're very expensive, right? Like you have hoodies that are pushing like 600 RMB, 700.
Oh yeah. I remember seeing t-shirts for 400 or 500 too.
Yeah. So it's no surprise. But that sort of gives you some more recent color on how each of them are doing, I guess.
So from the near term with the inventory cycle to the long term, tell me, where do you think growth will come from in the domestic market? And we'll talk about the overseas market next, but yeah, where do you think growth will come from in the domestic market?
Yeah, yeah. Just on the growth figures itself, right? And because people, like everyone's talking about like Chinese economy, like being so bad. Are these companies even growing? And the answer is yes. So in 2023, Anta grew top line by 16%. And even Li Ning, who is the one struggling, still grew by 7%. So I don't think the growth story is over, especially the long-term growth story, right? You got categories like outdoor and winter sports, which is just getting started. And then you got, look at Fila, for instance. Fila still mostly just in tiers one and two cities. And a lot of these brands, like higher end brands, have yet to penetrate lower tier cities. Although I suppose that could take some time. So one argument that I've heard some people say, criticism, is just the fact that China already has too many brands. And does it really need another premium brand? Does it really need more? And I agree in that, in a sense. But then on the other hand, I'm also, so this is like this hypothesis that I'm playing around myself right now. Don't really know if it's true, but at least it's interesting that in recent years, that Chinese travelers haven't been traveling a lot overseas, right? They do a lot of domestic travel, but overseas travel has gone down a lot since COVID. And they used to spend a lot of money overseas buying branded goods. Also, you look at the Daigo or like the cross-border e-commerce channel, and there's been crackdown on that. And the level is like permanently lower since COVID. So I mentioned all this because I wonder if there's more room because of this for more brands to expand their presence in China, perhaps, because more money is just simply being spent domestically.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if you look at how Anta is building the portfolio of Amer brands and Descente, they're really reinventing the in-store experience. So rather than this being one part of a multi-goods or multi-brand store, you can now go into a dedicated Arc'teryx store and have a much deeper connection with the brand, see a much like wider range of apparel and footwear, and begin to build that emotional connection, which I think is so far proving to be quite successful.
Operating a multi-brand, I guess we talked about the pros and cons, right, with that. But one of the things people will bring up is, and this is how a lot of companies got into trouble, which is they over-diversify, right? It dilutes their focus and all that. But what's really impressive at Anta is just they're diversifying, but then they're also executing really well in each one. So I just found that part to be quite impressive. They don't seem to have lost focus.
And then looking to the international market today, do you think these brands can sell elsewhere? Do you think Anta and Li Ning have appeal in other countries too?
I think so. It really depends on what region outside we talk about, because for obvious reasons, US and Europe will be very difficult. And I'd be very surprised if they decide to deploy a lot of money there. Amer is like, I guess, a different story because it's already in the Western markets. I think the biggest opportunity for the Chinese brands today is probably Southeast Asia. This is something that I'm monitoring with a lot of interest. Because if you think about the people, physically, I think they're a lot more closer to the Chinese body shape and style. And as like apparel is quite difficult to get across geographies because of these things. Also, Southeast Asia, I think the price point is much more similar to China, if not even lower. So that's where I think they'll have a pretty good shot overseas against the Nikes and the Adidas of the world.
You're talking about like the core Anta brand.
The core, the core sportswear brand.
Okay. And then Amer, Salomon, Arc'teryx, Wilson, and the other brands, how do they fit into Anta's strategy?
Obviously, as I mentioned, so the outdoor and winter sports is a key area. And then with the Amer, that gave Anta the best portfolio in China for this. The other part I think that's interesting about just the Amer acquisition is that it broke Anta's usual playbook in a sense that Anta usually just buys the China carve-out, right? Like the Fila, the Descente, right? They don't acquire the entire brand, like the company. But this time with Amer, they actually bought out the entire overseas company. So that's different. And what, like, one thing that really tells me is that Antaz has this global ambition that they're serious about. Because if they just wanted to do China, like, why do this, right? Like, just carve out Arc'teryx and just do that part only. But they must feel like they can add value to Amor. Not only bring Amor to China, but perhaps the other way around.
Yeah, well. For sure. Why didn't Antaz take a controlling stake in Amor?
So they did take a controlling stake, but you mean why didn't they buy out the whole company?
Yeah, why did they bring in outside partners? And I think as part of the IPO process, you're right, they did have a greater than 50% share, but it seems to come down to, I think, the mid-40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just the fact that this buyout was unprecedented, both in terms of scale, but also the fact that they're buying an overseas company for the first time, and they have no experience. And I look at it actually as a very, like, so the consortium, it was a very smart decision, I thought. Just look at who they partner with, right? Chip Wilson, who is Lululemon's founder, it has 20% stake in that consortium. So to me, it actually shows just like how, because like you can easily imagine, right? Like a firm like Antaz that's been so successful in China, they could easily get pretty overconfident with their ability to just acquire businesses and operate them. I think one thing it does show is just how self-aware Antaz's founder is, Ding. I thought there was like a lot of humility on his part to do this under a consortium.
That's a good point, actually. And now one of Chip Wilson's lieutenants is heading Arc'teryx.
Yes, yes. I think that couldn't have happened without probably Chip Wilson's influence there.
Exactly. And I know like Amor is a side business per se, but any idea what it needs to do to become profitable?
So don't quote me on this, but I still have to run through the recent results. But I think once you back out the interest rate that Amor is paying and also some impairments related to one of their smaller brands, then the business is already profitable. And so the question is like, how do they grow the profitability? I think Arc'teryx is actually already quite profitable. And they're putting a lot of effort now into reinventing Salomon for the Chinese market. And so that's one thing that to really watch. And I believe Wilson might be their lowest profitability segment, although it's a completely different sport category, right? Both sports and equipment.
Yeah,
yeah, but I don't really know enough about that, actually.
Yeah, and it's mostly wholesale, not DTC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. It's been so interesting speaking with you. Do you have any closing thoughts as we wrap up?
One thing maybe I would add just in the end, because really this is a question that I get really often, which is, China's economy struggling, right? Like, how is it the case that these brands can just do well, right?
Yeah.
And because if you look at the sales of Descente, Arc'teryx, Lululemon's like growing like crazy in China. Like, they're growing at a clip of 40, 50, 60% per year. Very counterintuitive. But on the other hand, it's like, it's not the case with all premium brands. And case in point is like Li-Ning's. They've been also trying to premiumize, right?
Yep.
1990 series, they're really struggling. I was actually just talking to a reader of mine about this and came to a conclusion that premium brands can still do well, but I just think like the hurdle is higher than before. And the value proposition of these brands just needs to be even more clear more clear than before. And one of my readers brought up a really great point regarding just this whole bifurcation dynamics in the market. So he used this example of, you see these fashion trends, people wearing like a basic white t-shirt, right? But like a t-shirt you can just buy on like Temu or Shein or wherever. But then on top, they have these like Chanel bags. So like these extreme fashion sort of things. And like in the West, you got brands like Hugo Boss, right? Where these ones are like in the middle. And maybe like the value proposition there is not as clear. And which is why some of these brands have not been doing so well. Again, I think premium can do well. You probably need, we're seeing a bifurcation. And if you're a premium brand, you probably got the hurdle's higher today than ever before. That's the way I see it.
And I think sportswear is so interesting because of the technical factor, and the technical excellence can become its own form of luxury in many ways.
Yeah, like every brand loves to, they'll talk about all the technology, right? Like their sole technology, cushioning, all these things. I do think they're real, but I've always found it hard as a consumer, both as a consumer and investor, to really know what really is the difference between the leaning soles or like the Nike soles, or, but clearly there's sneakerheads are paying attention. Like I have another friend who's also like huge sneakerhead, and he's actually living in Hong Kong. He came from Canada originally, in Hong Kong now, but he was just telling me like he's been so impressed with Anta's basketball shoes.
Oh, really?
He told me he owns 5 pairs.
Wow.
Because, so he's like, everything's on point, like the design, the everything, like even the endorsements of these players. He's just raving about Anta's execution there. So I thought that was interesting.
That's a good data point. Okay, so just to wrap it up and to remind everyone, it's the East Asia Stocks Insight Substack, Day Dung. And Day, how can people reach you if they want to get in touch?
Yeah, so my Substack's www.eastasiastocks.com. I'm also on Twitter or X a lot. And the handle there is, again, East Asia Stocks. So message me anything. Oh, by the way, I'm also offering a free trial now on my Substack. So you can access all the articles for free, including this one we talked about on Chinese sportswear. Check it out. And yeah, and thank you, Graham, for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. It was great to speak with you.